Hold it, fellas. Now, don't move me. Let's get real, real gone for a change.
It's time to get real gone on the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour. Here's your host, James Riley.
This is Jammin' James Riley on your favorite hour for great music and interviews. It's the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour. Hey, coming up on the show today, we hear part one with Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Duane Eddy.
And here come Don and Phil rushing in. They said, our dad plays like that. His name is Ike Everly, and he plays that thumb pick, and he didn't know you could do that.
Lots more coming up from Duane Eddy in just a little bit. Now let's kick it off with some friends of Duane's from back in the early days of rock and roll. The Everly Brothers from 1960, their B-side of their When Will I Be Loved single and the cover of Bebopalula. But first, Duane told me off mic he was with his friend Eddie Cochran in England just 2 days before his untimely passing. Here is Eddie Cochran in Mean When I'm Mad on the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour.
You petrify me, baby. You satisfy me, baby. But don't defile me, baby, 'cause I'm mighty mean when I'm mad. You tantalize me, baby. You hypnotize me, baby. But don't surprise me, baby, 'cause I'm mighty mean when I'm mad. Don't want my loving from another girl, 'cause you mean more to me than this whole wide world. I need your love and I need it bad. Watch out, baby, if you make a man mad. So hug and kiss on me, baby. Act like you missed me, baby. But don't resist me, baby, 'cause I'm mighty mean when I'm mad. My love from another girl, 'cause you mean more to me than this whole wide world. I need your love and I need it bad. But watch out, baby, if you make a man mad. So hug and kiss on me, baby. Act like you missed me, baby. But don't resist me, baby, 'cause I'm mighty mean when I'm mad.
Well, Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't mean maybe. Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't mean maybe. Bebopalula, she is my baby. Down my baby, down my baby, down. She's a woman in red blue jeans. She's a woman that's a queen of the teens. She's the one, a woman that I know. She's a woman that loves me so. Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't mean maybe. Bebopalula, she be my baby down, my baby down, my baby down. Got that beat, and she's a woman with the flying feet. She's the one, a woman that I know. She's a woman that loves me so. Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't mean maybe. Bebopalula, she is my baby down, my baby down, my baby down.
She's my baby, Bebopalula.
That's the Everly Brothers with Bebopalula. Also, of course, one of Gene Vincent's signature tunes. Now we begin our chat with Duane Eddy on location at the Musicians Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville, Tennessee in just a moment. But let's hear Duane playing guitar on a track by the Sharps in 1958. Now, they later changed their name to the Rivingtons and had hits with songs like Papa Ooh Mau Mau. Now they can also be heard doing the yells in Duane Eddy's Rebel Rouser, which we'll hear next time during part two of our interview. Also a great story that Duane tells about the song appearing in Forrest Gump. But right now, let's go back to 1958 with Duane Eddy and the Sharps and Have Love Will Travel.
Hi, this is Duane Eddy, and you're listening to my favorite Rebel Rouser, Jammin' James Riley, on the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour.
I have a lip.
Have a lip that's meant for you.
I have a arm.
Have an arm that is strong for you.
I have a leg.
It's Jammin' James Riley on location at the Musicians Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville, Tennessee, with someone that not only has his picture on the outside of the building, but a member of the Musicians Hall of Fame, Mr. Duane Eddy. Duane, thanks for coming out here.
It's my pleasure. It's nice to be here. And I'm honored that we're in the Musicians Hall of Fame. It's one of my favorite places to be.
Yeah. Well, now, you've influenced countless guitarists. I would imagine pretty much anybody that's picked up a guitar in the last 50 years. Who influenced you? Who influenced Duane Eddy?
I grew up listening a lot to country music. Hank Williams, Lefty Frizzell, Carl Smith, George Jones later, Webb Pierce, Farron Young, all those country artists. And, of course, I listened to Chet Atkins and Merle Travis. I love and Les Paul. Those three were big influences. And though I didn't know it, Hank Garland and Grady Martin were session men here in Nashville, and they played on a lot of my favorite country records, but in those days they didn't list the guitar players on the records, so I had no idea who was playing what, you know. But I would learn, and Billy Byrd, he was another one, and he played with Ernest Tubb, and you'd always know it was him because Ernest Tubb would sing along, and then when it came time for the guitar solo, he'd say, "Oh, Billy Byrd," and Billy would take off on a single note solo, and I could learn to play that note for note, and it helped my playing. And I used to come home after school and turn on the radio and sit down on my guitar. And in those days, they didn't tune every record to 440. A lot of them didn't have piano, no drums, and a country radio. So I'd tune real fast. And then I could play along with them, you know. Then the next record would come along and it'd be a hair flat, you know. And I'd have to tune down a little. But anyway, I did that, and sometimes I lucked out and was in tune with it from the beginning and could play along with it. And that's the way I learned new chords, new songs, and new licks. Taught myself to play that way.
Tell me about a early duo, you and Jimmy Delbridge. I remember there a couple great tunes, Soda Fountain Girl and I Want Some Lovin', Baby.
I wouldn't call them great tunes, but they were Lee Hazelwood's first attempts at songwriting. And that record was his first attempt at producing a record. And Jimmy and I, our first attempt at singing on a record. And I wasn't a great singer, and, well, he was not exactly Elvis Presley either, but he did, I don't know, we were about equal, I guess. And we did Wilburn Brothers and Lubin Brothers, Delmore Brothers songs, and, you know, anything that had harmony with it. He played piano, and I played guitar. And we'd go to Phoenix. We lived in a town between Phoenix and Tucson called Coolidge, down in the Arizona desert there. And we were both going to high school. I was 15, he was 16. We'd play every day at his house where he had a piano. And then Lee came to town and worked at the radio station on his first job as a DJ. And he wanted to get in a bigger market, so he took us up to Phoenix to be on the talent show up there that would open for the big name country act. And then after the big name country act got through, they'd clear the chairs away and have a big dance. They'd have a dance until 1 a.m. So we were on the first portion in the talent show, and we did very well. Jimmy was a character. He would, and he was taller than me. He was about 6'2½", and I was 6'1". We were both skinny kids, but, you know, I'd play my guitar. He couldn't play the piano and stand next to me to sing in the mic, and it didn't look, and he'd be over there. It was hard to sing with him, so he gave up the piano for that and just come up, stand beside me and sing. And he'd be singing along, working hard, and we'd do these up-tempo things like Truck Driving Man and Foggy Mountaintop and about that tempo, you know. And whenever the high notes would come, he'd jump up. He'd go, whoa, just give a big leap into the air to get them. And people got real tickled at that. And we were just, we didn't know what we were doing rockabilly, but didn't have a name yet. We just called it hopped up country music, you know. Hopped up wasn't what it became later either. That's what we called it. Tore the roof off the dump, you know. And it was just fun.
I don't think people really knew what to call it back then. I mean, it seems like rockabilly was a term that came later.
Yeah, it had to be rock and roll before there could be rockabilly.
Sure.
There was just hillbilly and country and so forth. We did that for a few years. We made a record, those two songs you're talking about, but it never got released because Jimmy quit. He got saved in church.
Yeah.
He came in one day and says, guess what? He said, I got saved. I said, saved from what? He said, no, saved in church. You know, oh, well, congratulations. And he said, well, the bad news is I can't sing with you anymore. And I said, why not? He says, I can't sing worldly music. And I thought, we're singing country. I never heard of worldly music. What is this? And he says, anything that's not church music. I said, well, you can tell Lee, he just ordered all 500 copies of the record to ship out to radio stations and all that. So he did.
I want some loving, baby, and I don't mean baby. I want some loving, baby, loving right now. I want some kissing, baby, see what I've been missing, baby. I want some kissing, baby, kissing right now. Don't try to run away from me and don't try to get wise, 'cause it's time you settle down and kiss someone your size. I want some squeezing, baby, so stop your teasing, baby. I want some loving, baby, loving right now. Thank you.
loving, baby, loving right now. I want some kissing, baby. See what I've been missing, baby. I want some kissing, baby, kissing right now.
Don't try to run away from me and don't try to get wise. Cause it's time you settle down and kiss someone your size.
I want some squeezing, baby. So stop your teasing, baby. I want to love and baby, love on right now.
The sounds of sirens, subways, and busy crowds of people makes Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Dion feel right at home. New York Is My Home is the latest project from Dion and co-produced by Jimmy Vivino, featuring guest vocals by fellow New Yorker Paul Simon on the title cut.
I'm not alone. New York is my home.
New York Is My Home contains 8 new Dion compositions and 2 choice blues covers. The result is pure rock and roll from the legend that's lived a lifetime defining it.
I can't go back to Memphis. I'm just not too wrong.
Dion, New York Is My Home.
Big Al Sear. Honking, moaning, rocking, righteous red.
New York Is My Home from Dion, available from Instant Records. We're back on the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour. We just heard the duo of Jimmy Dale and Duane Eddy with I Want Some Lovin' Baby from 1956. Duane Eddy is our guest this week, and we're talking about this time period where the duo broke up just after recording these tunes. Here's Duane.
I went away to California and worked at the gas company over there in an office for 6 months, I guess. Then I got so homesick, I quit and came back. And first thing, I run into Jimmy, and he says, guess what? I can sing with you again. And I said, really? How can you do that? Did the church change their rules? And he said, no, I backslid. So we went up and sang again at the place in Phoenix. And when I was up there, man, people were yelling and having a big time, and we were too, and just rocking out. And I thought, man, this is what I want to do. I don't know how I'm going to do it, because I don't picture myself being a hit country artist, you know, singer. And didn't even occur to me to do instrumentals at that time. I knew I wanted to do it somehow. So anyway, fast forward a couple of years after that. Actually, that was late 55. So in 57, Lee had a producer record with Sanford Clark called The Fool, and it was a top 10 record all around the country. So he kept trying to make more, and he recorded everybody that hummed a song in Phoenix, but he couldn't get anything else. He even tried instrumentals with other guitar players and stuff. And they were all signed up to all these little labels in California, you know. So one day he came to me, he says, I want to do an instrumental, but everybody's all signed up. He said, you're the only one left. He said, why don't you go home and write something? And I went home and wrote a song called Moving and Grooving. And we cut it and put it out, and it got up to number 70. It came out in January 58. They said, the record company back in Philadelphia said, well, go back in and do something else. And so we went back in March and got to the session, and I wrote, I had the drummer play a backbeat, and I wrote Rebel Rouser. We finished that up, and it came out, and was the big hit of the summer. The rest is history, as they say.
We'll be right back.
tell me how your twang sound came about.
I knew from listening to the country records, Hank Williams, and later on Buck Owens and people like that. You know, I knew I had to have my own sound, my own style, which I achieved by having playing on the bass strings because they were stronger and more powerful. I used a DeArmond tremolo, which gave it a little different sound. I didn't use it on Movin' and Groovin', but I did on Rebel Rouser. Movin' and Groovin' was kind of an experiment. I did high notes and low notes, you know. And I thought it was kind of dumb, really. You know, just one, two licks, you know, put together. But when you put the sax overdub on it and everything, it worked. So became one of, in fact, it was one of the influenced all those surfers out in California, and a lot of people give it credit for being the first surf record instrumental, which if I'd known they were going to do that, I wouldn't. No, I'm kidding.
Your debut album, Have Twangy Guitar Will Travel, now that stayed on the top albums chart for 82 weeks, a year and a half. That's pretty remarkable.
And got to number 5 in the charts, and didn't stay there, but for those 82 weeks, darn it. Yeah, it got up to number 5 and in the top 10 and stayed there for a few weeks, I guess, in the top 10, different numbers. But then it'd fall, and then it'd come back up and fall and come back up for over a year and a half, along with South Pacific. It was the other one that did that. I think it stayed a few weeks longer, actually. But myself and Elvis Presley were the only ones doing albums at that first. I was the only one doing stereo and rock and roll. Because we, after we did Rebel Rouser, the studio in Phoenix there invested in a 4-track machine. And so we had 2 tracks each side so we could do stereo. And I did my part of my first album, Have Twangy Guitar Will Travel, the one we're just talking about, in stereo.
From the 1958 album Have Twangy Guitar Will Travel, that's a tune I almost lost in my mind by our guest, Dwayne Eddy.
I remember you telling me a story about a conversation you had with Elvis, him asking what you liked better, mono versus stereo.
It was fun talking to him. He was just the greatest guy, and he was just exactly what you'd want him to be, you know, if you were a fan or if you weren't. I watched him that evening. He had the best manners of anybody I ever saw. because it was a farewell, a goodbye party. You know, he worked at the Hilton for several weeks, and this was the last night, and all the musicians, his father was there, and Priscilla was there, and all the people from the hotel, the promotion people and the directors and stuff that helped put on the show, all came up. They had a big buffet for him, and he circled the room and talked, and I'd gone over after the show, and he invited me up, and so I sat, and we started talking when he first came in the room there, and he said, "Do you like mono or stereo?" And I said, "Well, I like them both. I kind of like stereo." I said, "It's, you know, kind of new and different." And I said, "It's kind of cool to hear the whole band lined up there. Like, you shut your eyes, you can listen, you can just picture it." He says, "Yeah." He says, "That's okay." He said, "But I like mono." And I said, "Really?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "It's got all that power coming out of one speaker. It comes right out and hits you right in the chest." He said, pounds himself on the chest. He says, "I love that power." And he did. That's what he liked about it.
You referenced this earlier, but you were one of the first people to list the musicians on the back of your record, which is really cool. And something probably, you know, that helped influence other people. Like you were trying to figure out who was playing certain things. So that was pretty neat.
I wondered who played on those country records, and I never could find out, you know. Stories would drift back to us from Nashville, you know. Guys would come through with big artists, and they'd bring their bands along, and our local honky-tonk club guys, you know, that played in all the clubs around Phoenix would go back there and hang with them like a bunch of yokels and look and stare at them and gape at them and listen to them talk, you know, and sometimes some of the braver ones would just strike up a conversation. They'd say, "Well, that honky-tonk man by Johnny Horton, who played guitar on that?" They'd tell them, and then we would know that it was Grady Martin, or on Brenda Lee's that it was Hank Garland, or it was years before I found out that it was Chet Atkins doing the bunk chink, bunk chink, dunk chink on the Hank Williams thing, the tick, tink, tink, tick, because they had no drums, you know, so it was basically the drummer.
Hi, this is John Fogerty, and you're listening to Rockabilly and Blues with Jammin' James Riley.
This is Jammin' James Riley. We just heard Shazam from our guest, Dwayne Eddy. That song reached number 4 on the UK singles chart and number 45 on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1960.
You also perform frequently on Dick Clark's show. What was that experience like?
Very strange the first time I walked in there, because I'd watched it on TV and suddenly I'm there. And that's a weird thing to have happen to you. You know, sitting on my couch at home watching the kids dance and Dick talk, listening to the records, the music, not ever dreaming I'd be on there someday. And I walked in, it was very small. It wasn't a big studio at all. It was a little studio, and there's Dick's podium over there that he's on, and there's about 20 kids. It looked like there were 50 on TV. So I walked in, and I just did my record, you know. And I did it several times in the afternoon because he was on every day. I didn't go on every day, but I went on maybe two or three times in that first summer. And then he asked me if I wanted to go to Miami, Florida to do the first remote he was going to do for Saturday night. He had a Saturday night show also called the Beach Nut Hour, Beach Nut Gum, Chewing Gum. I said, sure, we'll drive down there. And did that first one and mimed the record, Rebel Rouser, which was in the top 10 by then, coming up on it. Played a couple other songs live to open and close the show, and it was very exciting. Came out, and all these kids, and you know, my car, I had a white 56 Chevy convertible that I bought the year before, and this is 58 now, and we hooked up a U-Haul trailer and hauled our stuff, and that's that. I took a bass player and a sax player and a drummer with me so we could do record hops and things, which we did a few of those with Dick Clark. Record hop is just for those who don't know, because they don't have them anymore, and there's a lot of young people that never heard of them or saw them or went to one. He'd hire a haul somewhere, usually a couple hundred miles from Philadelphia or 100 miles away, and he'd sell tickets for $1, $1.25, and all these kids would come in and dance, you know, and it was a dance hall. And he'd have his little sound equipment he'd put in the back of the station wagon, and his microphone and his turntable and his speakers, and he'd play records for 3 hours. He'd take three boxes of singles, one for each hour, hits, and the kids would dance like crazy to him, and he'd talk to them in between the records and walk away with several hundred dollars, you know. And sometimes he'd invite us to, or some act, whoever was there that week, say, you want to do the Friday night record hop? It's in Allentown, Pennsylvania this week. Sure, we'll go. Because we're there just to promote the record. We're not working yet. So I rock out and do Moving and Grooving and Rebel Rouser, and that was it. And then we'd go back to where we were staying. But it was fun. It was fun to doing his shows because, and the kids were great in those days. They just, you know, you could talk to them. And, well, except for the first night. That first night in Miami, I came out in my beautiful white Chevy convertible. I had lipstick all over the top. It was just covered in red lipstick. And I got out and put my stuff in the trunk, and by that time these kids came running from all directions, you know, probably 1,200, 1,500 of them. There was probably 3,000 people in the place. About half of them came out in the parking lot, saw me over there putting my stuff away, me and the guys, and they ran over to get autographs and all that, and I got up on the trunk, and I'm sitting on the trunk of the car signing autographs, and I see this girl pressed up against the back bumper of the car, just smiling up at me, and suddenly her eyes roll back in her head, and she just slumps down, and I realize she had the breath crushed out of her. She couldn't breathe, and she passed out. So I jumped down. I said, back, get back, this girl's. And she went to the ground then, and I picked her up. And about that time, here comes some police that were coming to save me. And they got there just in time to give her some CPR.
30 Miles of Bad Road by Duane Eddy. It's a tune he performed on Dick Clark's Saturday Night Beach Nut Show.
Let's talk about Phil Everly. He produced an album called Star Spangled Springer. Also of note, a version of The Air That I Breathe came out before the Hollies version, too. Just a fantastic record. I'm sure your friendship with Phil goes way back.
Went back to 1958 at the Brooklyn Fox, the Alan Freed show. They'd have 10 acts on the show, Bill Haley, Chuck Berry, the Everly Brothers, Jackie Wilson, Lloyd Price, Jack Scott, Jimmy Clanton, Bobby Darin, myself. We're all on the show, and we'd do about four or five shows a day. And they had a big orchestra backing up everybody. Of course, I brought along my own group, and they brought arrangements and passed them out, and the orchestra would play and back them up that way. It was a good show, great show. Lloyd Price was the first one I saw with, I guess they call them short people now. And they'd do Stagger Lee, and this little short guy would get shot. You know, well, they shot Stagger Lee. And he'd fall over. He didn't have far to fall, so it didn't hurt him. And he'd just fall over dead. And they'd act out the whole song as they did it. It was fun to watch, you know. They had some girl singing on there, and he had several big hit songs. Those people would all be on. That's where I first met the Everlys. And I was sitting there. They had these dressing rooms that go up about five stories, and they'd have five or six dressing rooms, and then they'd have an ante room, I guess you'd call it, in between them. You know, I mean, the dressing rooms were off this room, and there'd be a piano in there just if you wanted to play, or a couch to sit on, and softer chairs. The dressing room just had mirrors and bright lights and hard chairs, and it was a place to change and put your stuff, and then you come out and sit there and talk to the other acts, you know, sometimes. And I'm sitting there by myself one day and playing acoustic guitar ahead with me, and I was doing a little thumb picking like Chet. And here come Don and Phil rushing in. They said, our dad plays like that. His name is Ike Everly, and he plays that thumb picking. He didn't know you could do that. And I said, well, I don't very well. But and they said, well, sounds great to us. We'll have to get you together with our dad sometime. And I said, I'd love that. And we never did. I never did meet him. He passed away before we got to make that happen, because we were all running every direction, you know, in those days. But I don't know. And I hit it off with both of them very, very much so. But Phil kind of stayed friends. He was the one that would call me when we'd get home and stuff. What are you doing? Oh, just hanging out. Come on over to my place. I got to play you something. He'd play me Aretha Franklin, her first album. He already knew she was great and everything, you know, and going to be big. Nobody else did. It was a brand new album. Or very few people did, but sure enough, a couple, 3 months later, she'd be at the top of the charts, or she was at the top of the charts and went from there, you know. And I bought the album. I loved it, too. Well, he and Don both played the Beatles for me in England. They had a big suite there, and they had a sound system in it. And they had the vinyl album, first Beatles album. They said, you got to hear this group. They're really good, you know. Okay. So I listened to them, and they were really good. The songs were good, you know. I was a little critical of the sound because it was not as good as our sound we were making on records in America in those days. And it was not their fault. They only had a 4-track. We were up to 8 or 16 track by then. But it had that roughness and that funkiness and that drive and that sparkle. And sometimes, you know, the smaller machines bring it closer into you, and that's what theirs did. And it certainly communicated, and they became the biggest group ever. And but that Don and Phil played them. They knew that was going to happen somehow.
Years ago, when we started out, we went to New York City to work with Alan Freed, the man that coined the phrase rock and roll. That was the beginning of rock and roll. We were there. We were on the stage with Fats Domino, Little Richard, Buddy Holly and the Crickets, Eddie Cochran, Jerry Lee Lewis, Laverne Baker, Clyde McFadder, the Drifters, and another gentleman was there with us. And he's with us here tonight as our special guest. We're bringing him out here live on this stage, Duane Eddy. Thank you.
this is Jammin' James Riley, and we get asked all the time about advertising on Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour.
You could ask yourself questions.
Listeners could be hearing about your brand right now. New album, festival, vintage clothes, whatever is a good fit. We'll help you get the word out right here on the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour.
Do I feel lucky? Well, do you? Punk.
Email us now, rockabillyandbluesradiohour@gmail.com. That's rockabilly, the letter N, bluesradiohour@gmail.com. Your source for rockabilly, blues, surf, roots, early country, early rock and roll, and Ameripolitan music. This is the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour. Now, we just heard Duane Eddy's 330 Blues. It's from his debut album, Have Twangy Guitar Will Travel. We also heard a snippet of an intro that Don Everly would give Duane Eddy each night when the Everly Brothers and Duane were touring together in the early 90s. Now, for additional interview footage with Duane Eddy talking about producing Phil Everly and his friendship with both brothers, it's available on our website, rockabillyandblues.com. It's rockabilly, the letter N, blues.com. Some great stuff we just didn't have room to squeeze in here, but we wanted you to hear it. Now, this is part one of our interview with our guest and Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, Duane Eddy.
In 86, part of a Grammy for Best Rock Instrumental with Art of Noise, revisiting Peter Gunn. What was that like?
That was interesting because they were kind of cutting edge at the time, very avant-garde. And as JJ, one of the guys in the group, said, he said, yeah, they keep saying we're avant-garde. He says, I guess it means we avant-garde the faintest idea of what we're doing. A friend of mine was sitting with their label head, and he was complaining that he couldn't get them in mainstream. You know, he says, they're doing great in the dance market, the Yard of Noise. But mainstream-wise, they're not doing anything. I need to put them with somebody. And they went on with their conversation, and my friend said, well, I talked to Duane Eddy. And the label head said, snapped his fingers, said, that's it. My friend said, that's what? He said, that's who I could put with the Yard of Noise. Oh. And my friend says, well, I can call him. And the guy says, but what could they do? And my friend, he was frantic, trying to think of something because he really wanted to make it happen, you know. He said, the first thing popped in his mind, what about Peter Gunn? And the guy said, great idea. So they made an arrangement, and I flew over with my guitar and put my guitar on the track, and thing came out and was a hit all over the world, except in Middle America where the company, Chrysalis, had their promotion men and all that busted for cocaine and hookers and payola and all that stuff. The FBI was on them, so they just shut them down. But it was number one up and down the West Coast and East Coast where they still had their promotion people. Anyway, it only got to number 50 in this country, but it was number one in almost every other country in the world. And it was fun. It was fun doing. It was interesting. They didn't like performing. They were... Ann Dudley was, she won an Academy Award for Full Monty. She did the music for that. She did The Crying Game, too, but I don't think she won an award. She did win an Academy Award for the Full Monty, doing the music. And she arranged and produced Kenny Rogers in Paris. And, you know, she did a lot of different things musically. She was really a great keyboard player and great arranger and composer. Very talented lady.
you referenced the Beatles earlier, Paul and George, on a great album you did in 87 on Capitol, self-titled. Also had John Fogerty, Ry Cooder, and others. What was going on around that time period?
Well, when I was, the record was being a hit all over the world, the Peter Gunn record with the Art of Noise, we went to Switzerland and did the rock festival in Switzerland. While I was there, I ran into a bunch of artists, but one of them was Jeff Lynne. He came up, he says, "Duane, I know you're going to get a deal out of this record, this hit single." He said, "I just want you to know I'll do whatever you'd like me to do, a play, write with you, produce something, anything, co-write." He said, "I'd just like to be a part of it or do a track or two." And he says, "Because I know you're going to have a deal." And I said, and he said, he gave me his numbers and everything. So I said, "Okay, I'll call you." I didn't think anything was going to happen that much. But sure enough, a couple months later, I got a deal with Capitol Records. And I went on tour with Huey Lewis and the News around America and opened for them. And, you know, I was getting a little more high profile through all this, and Capitol wanted to do an album with me, so I signed with them to do the album and did the first two tracks with the Art of Noise here in Nashville. They were on their way from L.A. to New York, and we diverted them here for a couple of days, did a couple of tracks, and I just started. They gave me a great budget, and I just started putting things together, and I called Jeff Lynne, and I said, "Well, Jeff, you were right. I got my deal." And he said, "I knew you would." And I said, "Well," I said, "would you like to do something?" He says, "Well, I'd love to." He said, "but I can't." I says, just didn't say anything. He says, "and the reason I can't," he says, "is I'm working with George Harrison." He says, "I'm producing his album," which turned out to be Cloud Nine. He says, "I'm working with him on that, so I just can't do it." And I said, "oh, I understand. That's fine. No problem." I had no idea what I would have done with him anyway, you know. So, and I said, "but thanks for, you know," I said, "I was glad you turned out to be right." And he said, "okay." So we said our goodbyes and everything. I said, "tell George hello for me." And about 20 minutes later, the phone rang and it was Jeff. He says, "well, I told George who it was that had called me and what you'd wanted. And he wants to put his album on hold and do yours. And when can you come over?" I said, "how about next week?" He said, "that's perfect." Dee and I flew to London and went up to George's place and cut three tracks up there. And one of them was a little melody that Ravi Shankar had taught George. And it had a weird note in it, you know. And he said, "it's the weirdest, it's the greatest note I ever heard." Because it was an odd note. It just didn't belong there, but it worked, you know. So he says, "if you can finish that up." So I finished it up, finished up the song. So I co-wrote a song with Ravi Shankar, and without ever meeting or seeing him, just through via George. And so we cut that. Jeff came up with an idea, and I wrote the bridge. And then we had a rockabilly thing that we just threw together, and which George came up with the title, which I thought was hilarious. He called it Rockabilly Holiday. You know, only the British could think of putting Billie Holiday and rockabilly together. Yeah. Still cracks me up when I think about it.
You've been listening to the Rockabilly and Blues Radio Hour. Much more from Duane Eddy next time. Now, to take us out from his self-titled album in 1987 on Capitol Records, this is Rockabilly Holiday, produced by Jeff Lynne, and a title suggested by his friend George Harrison, who also played on the album. Now, we'll hear one of the tunes George played slide guitar on next time, along with stories about Rebel Rouser appearing in Forrest Gump, being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and so much more. Until then, it's Jam and James Riley saying, keep on rockin'.